Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
After Six, Brent McCall is here, a regular on the program now, used to be a cellmate of Michael Leibowitz, and co-authored a book with Michael Leibowitz while they were cellmates in prison, Down the Rabbit Hole, How the Culture of Corrections Encourages Crime. One of the crimes they committed while in custody was writing a book about the prison system that led them to be separated and transferred both to separate prisons, still inside the Connecticut system. So Brent is working on a follow-up book on his own right now. And we have fascinating conversations because, like Leibowitz, Brent's a really smart guy and a really thoughtful guy. And Leibowitz gives all the credit for his wisdom and tenacity in figuring things out to the inspiration he got from Brent. So good to have you here, Brent.
I'm glad to be here, but I'm afraid Leibowitz's suffering some false modesty there.
Well, that's good. We like that. It's a good quality. And certainly there's not a lot of it kicking around, so let him have it all. So
All right. Let's
talk about the police reform bill that is being considered by the legislature. We're recording this on Thursday, the 23rd, I think, of July. So this may be outdated. Even if we play it this afternoon, it might be outdated because we don't know what's going to happen with that legislation. But anyway, there is a movement to take away the ability of police to be protected the way they are now from lawsuits regarding how they perform their jobs. And we're going to discuss that right now with Brent. So what's your feeling on this, and why do you have feelings about it? What's your background with relationship to this issue?
Well, my only background in relation to this issue is really that I've read a bit about it, and I've been in the Department of Corrections for 25 years, where qualified immunity plays a pretty substantial role in allowing officers to misbehave, because they're essentially immune from much of the consequences. I just want to say that I'm opposed to the bill that's currently being discussed in the legislature, but I haven't read the whole bill, so I only am talking about the qualified immunity aspect of it. And the reason I'm opposed to qualified immunity is because it's essentially a bit of judicial activism that took place in the 1960s. And we'll talk about the history of that really quickly, if you will. Ultimately, police departments didn't begin to coalesce in this country until the 1830s to the 1870s, about that. So we've only had police departments in this country for, you know, roughly 160 years. So in 1871, Congress specifically addressed this issue about police accountability and, you know, what kind of liabilities they were exposed to in the Ku Klux Klan Act. And Congress basically said that that the government officials who violate citizens' constitutional rights shall be liable to the party injured. And I'm reading that out of a newspaper article by George Will that appeared in the Republican American on May 14th. He is opposed to the notion of qualified immunity for a number of reasons. But in 1967, the court basically invented the doctrine of qualified immunity, which was a spinoff of sovereign immunity, both of which it baffles me which would be part of this country, because I thought that we fought a revolution in the late 1700s to get rid of a sovereign who was immune from consequences and who was unresponsive to the needs of its citizenry.
So I understand your fear of it. I just want to jump in and discuss that idea, because once you have certain things, it's hard to imagine not having them. And this is rampant in issues around policing. For example, police carry guns. It's hard to imagine how we would back ourselves up and have police officers who weren't carrying a gun. And yet, they didn't always carry guns, perhaps. And sure, there are places in the world where they don't carry guns. You know, so it requires some imagination sometimes to even be able to go back and say, okay, first half of the country's existence, police officers didn't have any protections at all or what have you. What would be the alternative? How would you, because we know what a litigious society we have today, Brent. How would you, I imagine if there was the tiniest sliver of a law written that said you can sue police under these circumstances only if it happens while the officer is engaged in a handstand and no feet are touching the ground and he's standing on his hands at a whatever degree angle. And well, that would, in 10 years, that would be that you could sue the cops on anything, because the courts love to open these things up. How would they do their jobs if they were subject to liability lawsuits?
Well, I would assume they would do their jobs the same way they did their jobs in the 100 years prior to being granted qualified immunity.
Well, yes, but I need you to fill in for us what was different then, because something had to be different then. We similarly can't imagine. What's that?
The Burker Court, who was looking to give the Nixon administration co-conspirators some protections, essentially invented this qualified immunity out of whole cloth. So it strikes me as pretty disingenuous to hear somebody like Senator Markley, who's an intelligent conservative, to support a bit of judicial activism, however old it might be. That seems sane to me. But even besides that, I don't understand how the doctrine itself that was invented by the court literally out of thin air doesn't violate the First and Seventh Amendments. The right, in other words, to petition the court for redress, and the right to civil trial. If a judge can simply tell you that when your constitutional rights have been violated by an armed agent of the state, that he's immune from consequences, then what kind of First Amendment right do we actually have? And you know, he's negated essentially the whole notion of civil trial at that point. So what kind of Seventh Amendment do people have?
But Brent, the whole of the government works this way, does it not?
Well, that's not a justification for saying, okay, well, since the government's horrible, we should let them get away with it.
I'm not trying to justify it. This argument isn't the, it's an interesting one, but I don't think we can get to it until we understand the whole of this notion of immunity. And if we can get ourselves around the idea that it is even viable, that there could be cops who could be sued for everything they do. You know, we're living in this moment right now, and there's a lot of things that happen in this country that maybe aren't the way it was intended and aren't constitutional, but that huge institutional support and societal mechanisms have developed around. And you can't necessarily go back just by snapping your fingers and say this was created wrongly or by a wrong impetus. You've got to walk us back and create a scenario through which you can imagine, because I can't imagine there being police in our society today who could get sued for doing what they do, just as I couldn't imagine the governor of the state of Connecticut today suddenly being criminally liable or civilly liable for the things he does while in office. Every politician at his level is deceiving, tricking, doing things under false pretenses all the time. And if he could be sued for that, he would just have to be in court full-time, and I assume the police officers are the same.
Well, you know, perhaps that is the situation, but it rather surprises me to hear you proffer that argument, given that, you know, you're essentially the Atlas-like figure in Connecticut holding up the Republic. You know, ultimately, the question should boil down to principles. The best way to understand a government and to deal with the government is in principle. And I ask you, Todd, in principle, should armed agents of the state who have the most discretion to violate the rights of the citizens be immune from consequences, civil or otherwise?
I would say they shouldn't be if there's a way to develop a viable methodology for us to turn back the clocks of time. If we were starting from scratch, we would never put this thing in place. But principles have to live in a world in which momentum and power and certain laws of physics control what's viable. And nothing is viable, no matter how good the principle is, if you can't get people's heads around the principle and get them on board. When you have public support for something, say it's really bad, like government unions, you can't get rid of those government unions while the population is brainwashed around the idea that unions are good. Unions are obviously unconstitutional in my mind and obviously destructive to notions of democratic principles, and yet we have a political party that has lived off of them for, I don't know, 75 years or 50 years, whatever. And so you've got to deal with the political reality along with the principle is what I'm saying. I'm wondering...
Okay. I got you, and I've been thinking.
If you
about
and I
that,
stipulate to yes, we should be back there. How do we get there?
Well, I was thinking that okay, we have these unions in place; they're entrenched. But why not instead of individual officers purchasing these insurance policies to indemnify themselves against bad acts, pool their money and let the unions pay the premiums for these bad actors? And I'll bet you'll see a move to purge bad officers once the premiums start going up. Unions aren't going to tolerate bad officers in their ranks if their, you know, insurance premiums are going through the roof. And I think that you could...
Well, you're making a really good point right now, I think, and one that everybody should really hear. We're talking to Brent McCall. He's a prisoner in the state prison system, and he's the author of Down the Rabbit Hole. The point you're making is important, and it's demonstrating that the reason there is the ability, there should be an ability, or there would be an ability to sue somebody in any walk of life for malfeasance is so there is a marketplace that can correct for that malfeasance, and we need that to happen. So that's what we need lawsuits for, and that's why your argument is an intriguing one. Brent's got to call us back. We'll continue in a sec on WTIC.
The caller has hung up.
Continue our conversation on After Six with Brent McCall. We were interrupted by technical problems and took a couple of days off. But we were talking about the intersection of principles and reality and how I think it's a different world if you're starting from scratch and you know the principles you want to build on versus when you have a society like ours, which has walked long distances from its principles and now is trying to make policy with a long history of infrastructure and policies and habits and perceptions of reality that are based on a contortion of what we're supposed to be doing principle-wise. So I wanted to give Brent a chance to respond to that. Go ahead, sir.
Ultimately, I spent a little time thinking about this, and I think that the problem with the viewpoint is that if you abandon the principles just because you've sort of migrated away from them a little, and that becomes a justification for not, for saying that we can't obtain that situation once again, I think it's a huge mistake because, how am I trying to say this?
Well, let me jump in for a sec because I'm not suggesting abandoning principles, but that you can't go 180 degrees into just going by principles when you've been operating in a way that's taken you far from your principles. So instead of jumping back to being principle-based, you have to move in that direction so that people can understand, because it takes time to build the argument for people. And in a democratic society with democratic systems, people need to get used to the idea. You need the support of the people behind doing things the way you want to do them, principles or no principles.
Well, I suppose that's true, but if you think you're going to get back to your principles without disrupting the status quo, I think that's an enormous mistake. I mean, people, you know, situations exist in society because there's vested interests, and, you know, that's no less true for qualified immunity. There's vested interest in, you know, having this immunity from civil consequences for police officers. Although the doctrine's only, you know, roughly 50 or 60 years old, they become quite comfortable with it, and you know, there's a long list of cases that demonstrate abuses of this power where, you know, there's victims behind these abuses that get no ability to redress, you know, their grievance because the courts have said you're barred because of this immunity issue. And I think that we can't lose fact. We focus a lot on police officers, but I think we can't lose fact of the you know, that there's victims behind these victims of you know, bad policing. And to say that we can't roll this back because, well, we've now had 50 years of it, is to me seems like it's to abandon the principle. If you're not going to be willing to upset the status quo because there's going to be pushback and growing pains, then you're never going to achieve a principled government like we once had.
Yes, but I'm not suggesting any of those things. I'm just suggesting that changes need to be reality-based. So, for example, if you wanted to get rid of welfare, or you wanted to get rid of federal involvement in public education, or whatever the thing is, you would base that decision on the principle, and then you would build a plan to get to where you're fully in tune with the principle. That may take 5 years or 10 years. So if you want to take away the qualified immunity that police officers have and give people the chance to sue them, you would need some way. It would take, no matter how you implemented it, it would take a certain number of years before you got there because the systems have to adjust. And you would want to minimize the turmoil, so you would build some kind of transitionary plan to where you could move in that direction. Because who knows how those things are going to flesh out in the mix. Whereas if you just started or if you had left our system the way it was and it had come into the modern era without ever protecting government officials from lawsuits, liability suits, then you would, those things would work out incrementally and there'd be no shocks to the system. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is before I take you outside on a cold day, I want to put a jacket on you. That's all.
Right. And I get that. And I think that the idea of buying insurance, officers purchasing insurance, whether it be through their unions or however they go about doing it, is a step in that direction. It gives them coverage. I mean, we expect roofers to buy insurance. We expect plumbers to buy insurance. We expect landscapers to buy insurance, doctors. Except when it comes to police officers, we're like, oh, no, they should be completely immune to any consequences for poor performance.
Yeah, and all I'm saying is if you were to make any analogous industry and think about it being in the situation where the police are now, they're not used to, they have no memory of, there is no system for them to look at that they can relate to that is practicing it the way that we're suggesting. So the shock would be such an incredible shock that nobody would say yes to it until you laid it out, how step by step we would get from point A to point B and how we might resolve these issues between us. So, you know, I think if you suddenly took away qualified immunity, there would be tons of lawsuits and nobody would know how you would finance the defense of those lawsuits. And you would see lots of people leaving the business and a lot of people deciding not to come into the business because it was became too unclear. It would become too unclear what kind of living they would make and how those costs would be apportioned. So if you found some way to transition into it over a five-year period, and then maybe you could get people to sign on to it. And by the way, one of the things I think you have to have the chance to argue with people is why it would be better. And people aren't used to looking at things that way. People aren't used to actually figuring out what would be better and why might this be better to have no qualified immunity. And if you take away their fears and their fear-based arguments, then they can maybe calm down enough to consider why the principle that you're espousing is the best way to go.
Well, I think the reason why it's the best way to go is because if police officers are immune for violating people's rights, if they're no, you know, if, and it becomes difficult to tell the difference between a police officer and a criminal at that point. Criminals essentially,
Yeah.
Officers today have more ability, clearly more ability to violate the civil rights of its citizens than criminals do, and that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yes, and by the way, you know, my favorite way to deal with the police, as you know, is to get rid of the police unions, which serve no constructive purpose, are an election rigging scheme, are a third party special interest group. And they're, in my mind, mucking up the works. So we could get rid of them. And by the way, also be moving back towards a principle. That is, you don't force people to associate with organizations and representatives that they don't want to belong to and they don't want to have representing them. And I'm pretty fixated on getting those principles back where they should be as well. Brent, we've got to wrap up. Thank you, sir, for revisiting this topic and getting the conversation finished.
I appreciate the opportunity, Tom.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.